Hello and welcome to The Stack. On this week's show, we head to sunny Miami to speak with the founder of a leading independent store in the region. Plus, Christopher Masses from the wonderful Magazine B and Magazine F. And Chris Chermak speaks with the editor-in-chief of the English edition of Catimirini. Enjoy the show. From Midori House in London, this is The Stack, 30 minutes of print industry analysis, and I am Fernando Augusto Pacheco. We start the show in South Florida. Only last weekend, I had a little weekend stay in Miami and had the pleasure to visit Books & Books, one of the leading independent booksellers in the US. I have to say, their store in Coral Gables, the very first one, is a buzzy place and that sells a variety of great magazines too. So it was great to speak with Books & Books founder Mitchell Kaplan, especially this weekend, which is Independent Bookstore Day.
We opened our very first bookstore in 1982. Miami and the world was a very different place back in 1982. We're talking, you know, before the internet, before computers really do what they do. In many ways, back in the early 80s, it was the golden age of independent bookselling. There were a lot of people like me who were opening independent bookstores all across the country before Amazon, before the chains, before all of that sort of thing. So it was a very hopeful time, but it was a very difficult time in Miami. Miami was just coming off an extremely difficult year and a difficult decade. There's a wonderful book out called The Year of Dangerous Days, Miami in 1980. 1980 was a very pivotal year in Miami. You had the Mariel Boatlift had just happened. You had these horrible race riots, the McDuffie Uprising. And then you had the beginning of the cocaine period in Miami. That all was beginning to morph in 1980 and come together. And we opened a bookshop just 2 years after that. So to be a bookseller for over 40 years in Miami and watch the city remake itself has been a unique privilege that I've been able to have.
And it's funny you're talking about the beginnings, the past, and although Miami is booming, it's a fantastic city, everybody's talking about it, there's still some challenges, right? And I know your bookstore, you know, when coming to banned books, I know there's, you know, there's something going on in Florida as well, and I think you're quite a vocal person when it comes to it as well, right?
Yeah, we're in a very difficult political situation in the state of Florida. What we have is we have politicians who are trying to weaponize cultural issues, you know, for their own political gain. So we have a governor right now who has decided to weaponize books and this very horrible campaign to divide people based on, you know, trying to limit the freedom to read, particularly in schools, in public schools, which is an incredible assault on public education here in Florida as well. There's a terrible kind of an attempt to put in curricula and other kinds of things, which almost seems like a war on history, a war on the humanities. It's a very, very virulent time here. And we as booksellers, not only, you know, Books & Books, but, you know, everywhere, we are fighting the fight to try to bring to people's attention the fact that books should never be limited or banned, and that the freedom to read is one of the foundational aspects of who we are as a society.
And that's why bookstores like yours should be celebrated, and I think they will be, right? Because it is Independent Bookseller Day this weekend as well.
Right. It's one of the great things that, you know, that is so democratic about having so many different kinds of bookstores, that you don't have one or two buyers buying for the entire country. You have the variety of books being sold through independent bookstores. They're as varied as the people who own them. You know, as we all know, there are so many books published every year that no one bookstore could really carry everything. So really, selection becomes an exceedingly democratic effort.
And one thing I have to say about my visit to Books & Books, the one in Coral Gables, It was a bit later on the day, about 9, 9:30. It felt very buzzy, you know. There was a talk with an author. There were people drinking wine at the cafe, people buying magazines, in this case, me. So I loved that. It felt like a hub of people having a drink, you know, enjoying a conversation, and of course, buying books and magazines. There's so many events at Books and Books. I was having a look at the website. Tell us a bit more about that.
Well, the ethos behind Books and Books and the foundational spirit behind the bookstore is the notion of the third place. You know, the notion of after work, after home, where do you go? You go to a local neighborhood bookstore. And that's what we've been for 40 some odd years. And we've tried to be that hub that services our community. So to that end, in our main store in Coral Gables, we have a cafe with a beer and wine license. We have music on the weekends and on Wednesday evenings. And then we have a full series of events. We have over 400 events per year. So you happen to wander into one of those. Sometimes we have two events going at the same time. If you go to booksandbooks.com, you can find out what's going on with all our different events. Over the past, God, I don't know, the past week or two, we've had everyone from Amor Tolles to Michael Ndaje.
But Michio, just speaking up, you know, you're talking about how many events there are in Books and Books, which I find it fascinating. And you've also expanded the brand, especially in Florida. You have other shops. I did came across to the one in the airport. Very useful. Yeah. Very, very useful.
But what happened, what went on is that in 1982, we opened the first bookstore in a part of Miami called Coral Gables. We now have four bookstores in South Florida. And then we have a fifth in the airport. And then we have a sixth with a relationship with Judy Blume in Key West. So that's another store that is associated with us. So we have kind of like six different Books and Books locations throughout South Florida. And the main one is in Coral Gables, and Key West, Judy and George, who run that store, do a marvelous job. And so that's where we are after 40 some odd years. And it's almost impossible to believe. I mean, I was kind of in my mid-20s when we started, and it's been a blink. 40 years later, here we are. It's a really wonderful period right now, because what I'm discovering is a lot of younger people are rediscovering the power of bookstores, and that's happening all across the country. But, you know, with our cafe, people come, hang out, do their work, browse books, have a coffee, have a wine. So we really are, you know, fulfilling what our mission has always been, which is to be that community hub and to be that place where, you know, people just want to hang out and meet people. We're in such a very, very difficult period where we're so fractured. And the idea of community is so attractive right now, and meeting your neighbors and being able to talk and discuss things. It's the highest role that we can play as a bookstore.
And Michio, I have to say thank you as well for having a great selection of magazines. I think I love when a bookstore actually also sells magazines. I think it's very important because, let's be honest, there are few places these days where you can actually go and buy magazines.
It's true. And what I love is we put in the Coral Gables store, we have the magazine selection kind of outside in our breezeway, which I love. I love that whole idea of a newsstand. You know, I was brought up going to visit the newsstand every weekend to see what new magazines there were. I'm a real believer in printed media and the considered browsing that a magazine gives you, to be able to spend time off your computer and look through something analog and physical. Those are all things that I think I never want to see us lose at all.
And you are a busy man. You're not only the founder of Books and Books, but you're also a film producer, right?
Yeah, I started a film production company a number of years ago because I love to bring stories to people. So we did a film called The Guernsey Literary and Potato Peel Pie Society, starring Lily James and Mikhail Huisman, which we filmed in England, and it's based on the best-selling book of the same name. And then we did another one that we filmed in Dublin called The Man Who Invented Christmas, which is about Charles Dickens and the writing of A Christmas Carol. And then along with my partner, Paula Mazur, we also did another one called Let Him Go, based on a novel. So everything we do is books into film or television.
And finally, Michio, I mean, that part of Florida, South Florida, including Miami, it's growing a lot. I mean, population. There's a lot of money coming in as well. Do you see that also as an opportunity for those newcomers and to show books and books? Because, yeah, as you rightly said, Miami keeps changing. That's at least the feel from an outsider here in the UK. We're reading that a lot of people from New York are moving there as well. How do you see that that change in the city most recently?
Well, Miami has had a huge spurt of growth, and the growth comes from all over. And what is really going to be the challenge for Miami as to how we manage that growth and how we make the city livable for people who have been here for a very long time. The price of housing has gone up. We have all kinds of climate issues. We're kind of ground zero for sea level rising. We have to manage all of that growth. But in the meanwhile, you know, the great untold story is just how culturally diverse Miami is. You know, it's got all these, it still has the remnants of a Miami Vice kind of sensibility. And it's more than that. We have an amazing book festival that we do every November. We have a really incredible literary community here. We also have an art, you know, Art Basel. We're right in the midst now of a terrific poetry month series called Oh Miami. We have independent cinema here. I mean, it's a very vibrant, diverse community, which doesn't, you know, which a lot of other cities, you know, attempt to replicate. But for us, it comes so organically because Miami is a crossroads from Latin America, from the Caribbean, from Europe, from everywhere, you know. So it's this crossroads and people sort of settle here from all different kinds of places. So it's what has kept me here. I was born here. I left for a little while. I came back. But it's that diversity which keeps me going and which keeps our bookstores as interesting as they were when we first opened in 1982.
Thank you very much, Mitchell. What a pleasure. For more information about the bookstore, just go to booksandbooks.com. And whenever in South Florida, you know where to go. Earlier this month, Monaco's Chris Chermak visited Greece's largest annual conference, the Delphi Economic Forum. The forum is in its ninth year in the ancient city of Delphi, and it comes as the country of Greece is gaining new confidence as it emerges from a major economic crisis some 10 years ago. Among the Delphi Economic Forum's chief sponsors is Greece's main newspaper, Katimerini. Chris spoke with Tom Ellis, editor-in-chief of the English edition of Katimerini, about Delphi, the world of conferences, and about the future of the newspaper's English edition. He began by asking what has made Delphi successful.
We have many conferences in Greece during the whole year. But the Delphi Economic Conference, I think, has achieved a level of quality and quantity. I mean, there are almost, 3,000 people participating, which for Greek standards, it's something different. And I assume it's really a success story, conferences-wise. There's also the history behind the area, which gives it a certain touch. I've talked to people in Washington and actually in Brussels too about the conference in the past. And there were people who would say, I'm coming not only because of the conference, but also because it's not Athens or Thessaloniki, the major cities of the country, but Delphi. So it's something different. It's, I think, the main conference of the country. And the fact that every year they end up having a lot of not only our ministers and political leaders and business people, intellectuals from the country, from Greece, but what makes, I think, this specific conference different is the fact that they have a lot of leaders and ministers and journalists and academics from all over the world. So in that sense, it's the conference to be in Greece.
If it is the conference to be in Greece, what is it like for you as kind of the Greek newspaper to cover, to be a part of a conference like this? It feels like Katimerini is everywhere, intricately involved.
Actually, I'm shooting myself because we also do a couple of conferences, which are major conferences. And we did one a month ago, about 50 years after the dictatorship. But actually, we did it in cooperation with the people who do the Delphi Economic Conference. And there we had all the former prime ministers, or, you know, everybody. But being part of this, it's very useful because within the span of a couple of days or 3 days, you have the chance to meet either people you already know, but you do have the chance to, you know, chat with many major personalities in just 1 or 2 days, but also people you would not meet otherwise. Like last year, Tony Blair was here. He spoke in conversation with Alexis Papagelas, who is the executive editor of Kathimerini. You know, there are sometimes people you know you will not be able to meet somewhere else, and that's really special. And then you sometimes feel that in discussions with personalities that make a difference for the region and for the world, but mostly for the region, let's say, you do have an input. Because as a moderator, like this year, I'm doing General Petraeus, with whom we did a closed session last year. And we talked about Russia and Ukraine. So you get the chance to talk in a critical way about major issues in the world, but as I said, in the region too. Middle East, Balkans, where Greece is involved. Relations with Turkey, for us, is a major issue. But Turkey by itself is a major issue worldwide. So it's, again, getting back to the importance of the conference, I think it gives us a chance to influence, impact, be influenced by others in just 2-3 days.
Tell me more about your own conferences as you mentioned them. I'm curious how they all kind of fit together. It does feel like the print world. You've been at our Quality of Life Conference of Monaco when it was in Athens. There is this sort of fusion of print, but the importance of live events and running forums is something that we all kind of lean into at this point.
It's a different world, journalistically, developing. Our conferences, like as a paper, we are a joint publication with the New York Times. And we are published in Greece. The person who buys the New York Times buys a single paper with Kathimerini. The first 20 pages is the New York Times. The last 4 pages is us. So this December, we did a conference for the 25 years collaboration with the New York Times, which was very interesting. We did one on health, ESG. The good thing about being the major paper of the country is that most people, or most people of a certain quality, want to be part of the conference. So you don't go after people. I'm not saying they are after us, but I mean, it's easy, quote unquote, to host important people with whom you can have influential discussions about the issues of the day. Now, in our case, we are not necessarily doing what the Delphi Economic Conference does. We are actually, as Kathimerini, the leading paper of the country, dealing mostly with the issues the country faces. We do have input from abroad. Like last year, we had the health conference. We had Mario Monti, with whom we discussed health. And then we try to implement what we learn or the information we get on Greece, on our issues, how we can improve the situation in the country.
So that's the Greek focus. I was curious if you could also talk a little more about how your approach differs as editor-in-chief of the English edition right now when it comes to either forums, but also in general. I wonder what your coverage has been like at the moment. What are you highlighting about Greece in the world at this moment?
Actually, the English edition of Kathimerini is the almost opposite of the Greek one, in the sense of Kathimerini in Greece, the Greek Kathimerini, let's say, is trying to inform Greeks in an analytical way, critical way, whatever, but Greeks about what's happening in the world. Now, our job is the exact opposite, to explain, describe what's happening in Greece to the outside world. We're a window, it's either us a window to the world or we're a window to Greece, however you see it. Our focus is what people in Washington, Brussels, other countries, a lot of people in China come and read us. And actually, it's interesting that the main themes, the main issues they care about are cultural, which is not the case with the Greek one. The Greek one is mostly, culture is a huge issue, but the economy and politics is something that Greeks care about. In our case, foreigners care about mostly Greek culture. And then, let's say, during the crisis, we were the main source of information about a lot of people who cared about Greece because we were bigger than our size. So I remember a case where an investor was, I was at a dinner in Athens, and somebody turns and was very critical of me and us, the English edition of Kathimerini, saying, you know, where did you get this information about Merkel and Lagarde? Because we invested, I don't know, $50 million based on your information. Of course, it came out that we were true the next few days. But he was like, why did you have it and not the FT or somebody else? Well, being the main Greek paper at the time, always, but during the crisis, we were the paper that people from the IMF, from the European Commission, from the German government wanted to come to, so their point would get across the Greek public. So in that sense, being what Kathimerini is, we were able to have information that others didn't. And I was kind of proud, if I can use that word, that people, not only in institutions like the IMF and the EU, but even private, you know, investors, would be influenced, I hope, in the right way and balanced way, from what was published in Kathimerini, which confirms our influence and our role, in which I really believe in, be as objective and as qualitatively up to the highest standards. Because if your readers are the international institutions, the embassies, investors, academics, you cannot but be of high quality.
Is there an aspect then of this moment that, ironically, I suppose, is always the question for media outlets, that the focus, the attention is greatest during a crisis? Here at the Forum of Delphi, the focus is, you know, the topic is the great transition. Greece has transitioned out of that crisis. I wonder how that then has impacted you. The positive is, you say, now the focus is back on, is, so to speak, culture and more positive issues. But how does that impact what you write about and the attention you get?
Look, what bleeds, leads, we say in journalism. So when it's not bleeding, you're not, you know, people, I guess, abroad, all over the world, are not as interested as they were in 2012 or 15. But that's good for the country. So I am happy that maybe readership is going a little bit down because not millions of people care about Greece getting out of the euro or something. And we're back into culture and actually projecting the positive role that Greece, as a more developed, slowly and stable economy, can play in its region, in the Balkans. Or let's say on the geopolitical level, we are in a better situation right now with Turkey. Again, when it doesn't bleed, it doesn't lead. So when we were, like in 2020, there was a period in the summer when we were very close to almost some kind of, there was a lot of friction with Turkey. So a lot of people were reading because, you know, two NATO allies, could, what might happen? Do I look forward to another critical period with Turkey? No, I don't. So let it be peaceful. Let it be, you know, a nice coexistence, as nice as it can be with Turkey. But anyway, and if that means less interest by some people at the State Department, so be it. You know, I mean, I don't want to have 2,000 hits at the expense of the country going to war. So I'm sure if we go, let's go, I don't think we will, but I'm just saying, if you end up with a war, you might have, I don't know, millions of people reading. I don't need that. Let's keep the peace. And if that means less readership, that's fine. I hope culture and other issues will make up the difference.
And it's fair to say that things are still going well for you in that sense, that you have made that transition of your own, so to speak, into the kind of identity of what Ekaterini is abroad.
We feel we're getting better. You know, it's interesting when you go actually, and let me end with this, in conferences like this, where most of the people are, or a lot of them are foreigners. And, you know, honestly, I hear a lot of people saying, oh, you're the guy I read or something. That tells you something. And it's more responsibility. Because if this guy from, I don't know, Lithuania or France says, you're the guy I read about, you know, Greece, or what's happening in Greece, that says something about not necessarily me personally, but the paper or the site. That means these people do get their information and their analytical image of Greece through us.
That was Tom Ellis, editor-in-chief of the English edition of Greece's Katimerini newspaper, speaking with Monocle's Chris Chermak in Delphi. And now to another happy encounter this week. Recently arrived from Salone del Mobili after a special event with food publications. See our interview with Rafael Tonon from Farta magazine last week. A welcome to our studio, Christopher Massis, marketing and distribution partner for Magazine F, a food documentary magazine, and the excellent Magazine B, an in-depth look at a different brand every issue. He tells me how he fell in love with the titles and how well they are doing in the U.S. Here is Christopher with more.
My connection is that of a fan who wants more people around the world to share my passion for the agenda behind both of those magazines.
And you are also at Salone just a few days ago. I know there's been a special event they organized with food titles. Tell us, how was the event, and especially the connection with Magazine F? What did you guys do there when you were at Salone?
Well, I really salute Salone's vision to be not just a trade fair for manufacturers of products, but to show an understanding of the reasons that people and cultures love food and center food in their lives. So they invited us and five other international food niche magazines to Salone, and each of us were asked to prepare a demonstration interpreting the philosophy of our magazines into food, as a demonstration that, if we chose, we could prepare and serve to the attendees. It was a great challenge that provided a really stimulating month of trying to solve for this really challenging problem of how to express a magazine's philosophy in food. But we did it, and if I might say, it was well received by the attendees of Salone, and management seemed to like the idea of making a deeper connection with its trade audiences who were looking at products to examine the essential human connections behind those products, in this case, man's relationship with food.
And that's what both magazines, they deal with quality, right? Of course, Magazine B, you know, there's a profile of a company every issue, and they usually related, you know, from Porsche to Disney, I believe, in one of the most recent issues, and similar style to Magazine F as well. Was that the reason why you fell in love, as you say, to the both titles?
Both magazines are subtitled as documentary magazines. Magazine B is a brand documentary magazine, which in about 160 to 200 pages does what I like to call a 360-degree preview of a brand, what its origins were, why and how it was started, how it became a business, and how it operates now, how its leaders, designers, manufacturers, marketers, even people on the factory floor continue having that brand be successful. They also look around the brand at consultants, competitors, community, customers, and see how the brand is affected and affects all of those components as well. So you don't get just a strict business understanding. You get an understanding of a brand that's part of our cultural fabric of the way we live. You and I interact with brands every day and what we consider buying. Those brands are all reflections of the identity we like to see when we look at them in the mirror. Oh, I buy these products, which says this about me. And they're also reflections outward to the people around us. They are a way we present ourselves. So knowing more about those brands helps us knowing more about ourselves as people and ourselves as a culture.
I wonder, how's the U.S. market for both magazines? Because the U.S. is such a gigantic market. It's like a whole continent. How was the approach? Did you have a chat with the team in Korea saying, listen, there is a market for it in the United States, and I think it would do well? What was the approach like for you to convince them in a way?
When I discovered the magazine at Kinokuniya, a Japanese bookstore chain that has an office in Seattle where I live, I noticed that it was rather expensive. It was over $30. And when I looked into acquiring more, I realized that their distribution was relatively weak in the United States, and giving the pricing, I understood why. So I went to Seoul and had a chat with the team and became a distributor and found a new way to bring it into the United States that allowed us to dramatically lower the overhead price of shipping it, which made it a more attractive option for other stockists to pick up and more people to discover it. The magazine is based in Korea, and most of their marketing is directed at that audience. I thought there was a good-sized audience for the magazine in the United States, so we started having an English-language conversation with that potential audience, and it's gone rather well. Yes, the United States is a huge country, which makes it relatively easy to find the market that appreciates what Magazine B is doing. And we've had pleasant success with it there.
Easy, but at the same time, I guess you have to be creative. I mean, every time I go to the US, it's quite interesting, the idea of the newsstand. I think it depends on the city you go. So sometimes I've seen Magazine B in the US, but sometimes in specific shops, in clothing shops as well. So besides the traditional newsstands and bookstores, I guess you had to kind of expand perhaps the place you would sell the magazine, right?
Certainly. We've seen a lot of success in design and architecture focused shops. Even some clothing shops that operate on the higher end see Magazine B as a nice accoutrement to what they're selling. It's not in the center of what their sales are, but it appeals to the type of customer they like to bring in, and it helps them with their own brand and their identity of who they are.
What can you tell us? I'm sure you can't reveal all the secrets, you know, but what can you tell us about perhaps the upcoming issues? I mean, I know, especially Magazine B, they're celebrating 100 issues very soon, I believe. But I wonder what's next for the brand and for your work with Dan as well.
We just published issue 97. They started publishing in 2011. And yes, if we can all count, that means issue 100 is just around the corner. I so admire what they do journalistically that I have no comments and no notes to give them on that. And they're not particularly open to sharing that. They enjoy the element of surprise. I do know that they've had a run of issues on more obscure brands like the Korean city Busan, the English outdoor maker Barbour. And I know that they're going to be going into some more recognizable brands in the next year. But we can't really talk about that.
Of course.
What I'm hoping to do is continue to spend more time exposing Magazine B to audiences like brand fans for each magazine. There's a core set of people who will buy anything about that particular brand. Sales and marketing professionals and branding professionals who are interested in these as case studies, and C and B level executives and even startup founders. I was recently living in San Francisco, where I found a lot of people beginning their companies and interested in taking guidance from Magazine B about how they could start their company on the right path rather than having to re-engineer it later. So those are all audiences that we're working on addressing as we lead up to the 100th issue. But I can't say more about that.
That's not a problem. What about Magazine F as well, which is, I think the current one is all about wine, which is a fantastic topic.
The most recent two issues that were published, 28 and 29, were spice and wine.
Excellent.
Wine completed the alcohol trifecta, as they'd previously published issues on beer and whiskey. Their 30th issue, which will be published in English later this quarter and is currently available in Korean, is water, which is a nice pairing with their first issue, which was salt. It's so indicative of the type of creativity they bring to their thinking about food that they'd offer water as a food. I think Magazine F, if I may, is also unique in the food print universe because so much of the very rich collection of food books and magazines and videos are about there are about the way we combine ingredients. Whereas Magazine F looks at food from the perspective of where it starts, the individual ingredient, and gives us a documentary biography, if you will, of the food, starting with the origin. Where does this food come from? And how does the way we grow or raise, in the case of animals, food, reflect who we are as people? What transformations does food go through between its origins on the farm and the market? For soilage and transportation, for economic reasons, how does food change? And then what do different cultures do as they bring food to its final conclusion, the kitchen, our tables, and our stomachs? And what does that tell us, both about the food, our cultures, and ourselves? That is the journey of Magazine F, that each one reveals a new slice of not only what we eat to sustain ourselves, but what we spend our time with as mankind, 7 billion times a day, we write our memoirs with food.
And that's it for this week's show. My thanks as ever to our editor, Jack Jewers. If you have any comments or queries, feel free to write me a message at fp@monaco.com. We'll be back next Saturday at 10 a.m. London time. Meanwhile, you can subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. You've been listening to The Stack. I'm Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Until next time, it's goodbye from me.